waiting on the Lord and trusting Him. We're in a society where everything is in a hurry, and we've got a everything's fast-paced. I mean, you know, if you don't, you go home and dinner shouldn't take more than a couple minutes. You just throw it in the microwave and there it is, or you stop by and I don't know, McDonald's or Subway's and pick something up. I hope it's Subway. You're better off, isn't it? But a little more healthy. But you know, we're standing in line and waiting for our food, and it might not be more than 5 minutes, but sometimes we get into this thing, well, what's taking them so long, you know? And if I were to do it myself, it might be a half an hour, you know, to get it all together. And we're in this fast pace. Everything's got to be done fast, and you don't even realize it. I know that when I worked on the ranch, hoeing weeds and building fences, there was a pace there that was a little slower than the big city. And he got the work done, but when I worked for Disney, when I got into Disneyland, everybody was in a hurry, I noticed, and I'm thinking, okay, that's interesting. But at the same time, I won't get into that. It was really amazing. I mean, you get used to a certain work environment, then you go to another work environment, and everybody's complaining and about their breaks. And we didn't get breaks. I mean, I didn't know we were supposed to get breaks, but we'd work from 7 to noon, our first in the morning, 7 to noon, and there's no break. We were told, no, you don't work, you just work. Then it turns out there was a law. But anyway, it's my grandfather's fault. He made him, But David had a lot of waiting, waiting on the Lord, learning patience, not to be in such a hurry. After all, what is the big hurry? Why must we hurry? Why must we get things done quickly? Well, that'll leave more time for leisure and fun and things like that. But that is a rather foreign thing when you think about it. In fact, David, by the time he got to a point to where he was king, and the thing, the activities began to start and organize and so on, he stopped waiting on the Lord because he had a lot of work to do. Built the palace, right? He was in Hebron for a little while, about 7 years, and then he came to Jerusalem, and then he had all these things he needed to do. Building the palace, he didn't have to worry about building palaces when he was in the wilderness, right? He was just out there with the men and protecting some of the folks out there, the farmers that are working the fields. But he gets into town and he starts to get busy. And he got so busy that waiting on the Lord wasn't a major thing for him. There was a lot of things crowding out that waiting on the Lord. And, well, after all, the time had come, and there he is now, king. And so now he builds a palace. And, I got to build, you know, here I have this palace, and now I've got to build the Lord his house and all. And he finally got to a point, the Lord says, no, you're not going to build me a palace. And it finally got to the point where David was, he sent his men out to fight the war, and he stayed home in his palace. And one evening he ventures out on the rooftop. Of course, the palace is up higher than everybody else. He looked down and he saw this beautiful woman bathing. And so I thought, ooh, and he was tempted. And I ask you, was he waiting on the Lord at that point when he was? No, he wasn't. He wasn't. When he saw her, he asked for her to be sent up to him, and you know the story from there, what happened, and all the trouble he got himself into. He tried to cover it up, and it's never good to cover things up. It's better to get it out in the open with the Lord, to just, you know, confess and tell the Lord, hey, goofed up. Because he's going to, sooner or later, it's going to boomerang if you don't. Sooner or later, it's going to boomerang, it's going to come back and bite you. And so that's why we come to church, is to study the Word of God, to look at how God sees things. Because you see, He has, it's like, it isn't like He has all the a lot of time on His hands. He's not in a dimension that we can understand, right? Because we're in a dimension where there's time, and He's outside of time, and so He's not confined to time. That's not a problem for Him. And so He already knows how it's going to turn out, but He's working with you, specifically with you, to help you in this thing that we're in called time, to teach you things. And the greatest thing that He wants you to learn is love, right? These three remain: faith, hope, and love. The greatest of these is love. But He also wants you to learn faith and hope. He wants you to learn those things. And 1 Corinthians 13, verse 13 tells us that, and these three remain, these three abide, these three, they go on forever. These three, they go on forever. What are they? Faith, hope, and love. You think that when you died and go to heaven, you're no longer going to have a faith thing? You don't have to worry about faith anymore? That's not true. You read, if you look at the Greek for the word abide and remain, it means forever. So these three will remain. These three things, faith, hope, and love, and these are what we are learning. We are learning about faith, and in the process of learning about faith, you will wait. Die to your flesh, die to yourself, die to your, well, you know, my spouse isn't pleasing me, I'm going to dump this one and get another one that'll satisfy my needs. We just seem can't, we talk to each other and we just sort of talk past each other and we can't seem to, well, perhaps God set it up that way to teach you how to listen to somebody who's different from you. Because after all, perhaps you'll be doing that in eternity, right? So this is a good time to learn. Don't dump them because we just can't communicate. What, is it about this life? Really? It's about this life? you need to find it now, this Shangri-La, this El Dorado, this, you know, where they used to go try to find the golden city. No. And David knew this, but yet, even as he was learning about waiting on the Lord and learning about the essence of that is faith. I'm trusting Him in the midst of this thing called time, and I'm hoping, I'm looking beyond this life, that I'm this arena that we're living in, hope, knowing that He's going to come and He's going to complete the work that He's started in me. And in the process, He wants me to learn about love. What is love? And that right now is a $24 question. I know this is a little rabbit trail, but today we're being told love is something other than what the Bible teaches love is. We're being taught in our culture that love is a feeling that you will get. A good feeling, and it's non-confrontational. That's what we're being told. Love doesn't have any confrontation. Love is tolerance, tolerating everything. What's the problem with that? That's a whole. We can go on for a whole semester talking about that. What is tolerance and what is love, and how does love fit into this? David is our example tonight as we continue to study the life of this man and how he recognized that God loved him and accepted him for just who he is. And it was easier for him to confess his sin because he knew God unconditionally loved him. And even in the most horrid sin that he committed by committing adultery with Bathsheba and then murdering her husband, I mean, that's awful. I mean, that's about as bad as you can get. I don't know what's worse. Well, perhaps there are a few things that are worse. But the point is that David, when Nathan, the prophet, came in and pointed his finger at David and said, "You're the man," David didn't make a bunch of excuses, did he? Remember what Saul did? He made some excuses. And David didn't. He just, boom, he said, "You're right. I'm the man." And he went flat on his face. And then he began to seek the Lord about, you know, now how can we straighten this out? And Nathan's answer to him was, well, you know, you're going to have to reap what you sow. The child that will come as a result of this affair is going to, I'm going to take that child away. And not only that, because of what you did, you're going to have adversity in your family for the remainder of your life. David's about 50 years old at the time. That means for the next 20 years, there's going to be adversity in his family. Can you imagine? Here David is in the twilight of his life, the best years of his life, and now he's being told that his family's going to be a big dysfunctional mess. And so how do you deal with that? I mean, can you relate to that at all, that, you know, your family's a big mess, and so how do I deal with this? Well, one of the first things that happens is his oldest son Amnon begins to lust after his sister Tamar, his half-sister, and one thing leads to another, and the next thing you know, there they are in incest, incestuous relationship. And Tamar, if her full brother Absalom finds out what happened. And so Absalom just, okay, you know, just be quiet, stay with me, everything's going to be okay. And then Absalom is seething inside about what Amnon did to his sister. And so he begins, over the next 2 years, planning the murder of Amnon. And he finally gets that perfect arrangement where he can get all his siblings together. They have a sheep shearing festival, gets them all together. And it's outside of Jerusalem. It's away from Dad. He got Dad's approval, by the way, to get Amnon there. Even though Dad knew about Amnon, Dad knew what Amnon had done to Tamar. And you know his response to that? He was very angry. That's it. He was very angry. That's it. There's no family discussion. There's no confrontation. We don't know of any. We don't know of David going and confronting Amnon and Absalom and bringing them in. He was very angry, and then perhaps it'll go away. It doesn't go away. It didn't go away. Well, perhaps if we pretend that it didn't happen, that's where it comes back to bite you. Unless you take it to the Lord and lay it before Him and seek Him and ask Him, Lord, show me, give me wisdom to know how to deal with this. Absalom murders his brother Amnon, has him murdered. And so what does that do? So the adversity begins with Amnon, incestuous relationship with his sister, and then a couple of years later, Absalom has Amnon put to death. And so Absalom flees, and he goes to live with his grandfather in Geshur for 3 years. And then Joab, of all people, he's the one. Now you know who Joab is. He's the commanding officer of Israel's mighty army. In fact, Joab is probably the most mighty warrior of all of David's men. He's the one that intervenes into the family situation to try to fix it. Joab. You know who Joab is. He's the same guy that took Abner aside and stuck a sword up his gut and said, be dead. This is a tough guy. He's the guy that leads the military into war and battle. And so he's going to David and said, come on, you know, we got to get this right. What, you haven't seen your son in 3 years. You need to work this out. So David approves, you know, make a story, the short story, long story longer, I guess I would say. So Absalom comes back to Jerusalem, And he's there in Jerusalem with his father, but his father refuses to see Absalom for 2 full years. I mean, is that not dysfunctional? I don't know what dysfunctional is, if that isn't dysfunctional. But that was David's choice. And Joab intervenes again. It's Joab, once again, that comes in to try to, you know, Joab is pro-Israel. Joab is a patriot. Joab sees more of more importance the status of the nation of Israel to the other nations, and so he sees a problem here. When Absalom killed his brother, he saw, oops, this could be a problem for Israel. So that's, I believe, why he intervened. It isn't so much he wanted to fix a family problem. He saw a problem for Israel. He truly, not only was he a commander, but he was a statesman too. He was interested in preserving the image of Israel. And so that's really what he's doing the second time, as he's trying to get David to reconcile with his son Absalom. After all, Absalom could be king. He's the number third son. He's the third son. Amnon's dead, the firstborn. This other guy, Daniel, we don't know any, the secondborn of David, we don't know anything about. But Absalom's the third, he's the guy in line to be king. So Joab intervenes and he tries to fix the problem. But while he's doing this, Joab does not know that Absalom is concocting a scheme in order to win over his dad's approval and get his dad's a blessing by restoring this relationship. Joab succeeds in getting them together. David then, there's this beautiful time of connecting again, but Absalom, what does he do? As soon as his dad forgives him and everything's okay, Absalom goes to Hebron, and then he begins to undermine his father by winning over the loyalty of the Israelites. And this takes about 2 years, while he stands outside the gate in Jerusalem, and as people come to bring their problems and looking for the king's judgment, what Absalom would do is he'd pull them aside and he would say, oh, well, he's busy, let me help you. And he'd win them over, and he did this for 2 years, and he won the people over, going behind his dad's back. Once this process of winning over the hearts of the people was done, then we see things begin to happen. Here's a map of Israel, Mediterranean Sea, Israel, Judah in the south, and the Dead Sea, there's Jerusalem. And Absalom then declares himself king in Hebron. And once he does that, his father realizes that his own son has double-crossed him. His own son. So David, he flees from Jerusalem. And on his way, he crosses over the Mount of Olives. And then he comes to this place called Bahurim, which is just a little, not too far from Jerusalem. And while he's in Bahurim, as he's leaving in this dysfunctional environment with his son rising up against him, this fellow by the name of Shimei, who's from the house of Saul, as they're leaving and they're going through Bahurim, he confronts David and begins cursing David and throwing rocks at him. And Abishai, the brother of Joab, who's a commander, also another commander, said, let me take that dog's head off. You know, he can't be cursing the king. And David said, well, let him go ahead and do it. And we see the humility here as David humbles himself in light of what's happening. He could have easily killed this man, but he doesn't. And he said, well, what he's saying is probably true. And so we'll just let him, you know, maybe it's the Lord who's speaking through him, and maybe the Lord wants me to hear it. Now, is that not humility to do that, to be able to take the heat and not lash back, and just let him, you know, I had somebody flip me off recently as I was driving my car, and I guess I don't know what I did, but he pulled around me and went by, and he had, you know, his little thing sticking up as he drove by. And that, you know what that does to you? You know what it does. Doesn't that get, I don't care who you are, it makes you angry, doesn't it? And I felt it rising up. I don't know what I did. I don't think I did anything wrong. If I did, you know. But I didn't think I did. And so I got angry, and I thought, you know, think about David. Put yourself in his place. My gosh. So Shammai is kicking the dust, kicking the dirt, throwing rocks, cursing him out. And some of the things that he's telling him are, you know, probably true. David just says, okay, humbles himself, says, that's okay. That just might be true. So let him do it, you know. Now, David then, from Bahurim, he heads over to the fords of the Jordan, which is just right there by the Jordan. And while he's doing that, Absalom meets with Ahithophel and Hushai there in Jerusalem. So Absalom now is in Jerusalem. And you know who Ahithophel is. Ahithophel used to be like the Secretary of Defense for David. He was like the advisor, great guy. I'm great for a tactician and strategist for David. And David, he betrayed David. He probably an older guy. David's in his 60s by this point. This Ahithophel's older. He's probably retired. Now he's coming out of retirement. He's working for the younger Absalom. And so he's giving, Absalom asks for his advice, you know, well, what are we to do? And Ahithophel's advice is, well, you know, while they're sort of in disarray, as they're leaving, they're fleeing, they're not organized. So what you do is you go after them. And in the confusion, you get David, you single him out, and you kill him. You cut the head off of the snake, so to speak, and it's over. That's Ahithophel's advice. And Absalom was, you know, well, yeah, that sounds good. And then what do you say, Hushai? Now remember who Hushai is. He's the one David sent in as a spy. He pretended to be friends of Absalom. And Hushai says, well, you know, what you ought to really do is, you know, just give it some time, get all the tribes together, get a bunch of men, go in there, and then slaughter all of David's men and kill David, and then everything will be okay. Well, that wasn't good advice. Ahithophel had the right advice. And in fact, Ahithophel knew that once he heard Absalom accept Hushai's version and all his men with him accepted what Hushai said, he went out and hung himself because he didn't want to face David. He committed suicide because he didn't want to face the wrath of David. And so they accepted Hushai's advice, and that gave David some time to recoup and get back together. And so so Hushai then, of course, passed that along to Zadok and Abiathar, who told their sons, okay, go ahead and let David. They were all in hiding, and they said, go tell David what's going on. And so when David heard what was going on, he crossed the fords of the Jordan. And he traveled to, he actually exiled himself in across the Jordan in an area called Mahanaim. And that's where he recouped. And Absalom, in the meantime, pulled the people, large numbers of people together, fighters, and he went on just north of Mahanaim across the Jordan to Gilead. And so this is where the setting is as we now move into chapter 18. And so what I'd like to do now, I looked at Psalm 3 last week, because Psalm 3 actually was written during this time when David was fleeing from Absalom. And some of you weren't here last week, so I want you to focus with me on where David's mind is at this point as he's fled from his son. He's now exiled out of his own country. And remember, this happened to him before. Remember when Saul, he exiled himself out of Israel, only over in Philistine, the enemy territory. And he lived, remember, he lived in Ziklag for about 18 months as an exiled, hunted fugitive by Saul. And now here he is, his own son has driven him out of Israel. And now here he is, once again exiled in friendly territory. They're friendly because they actually helped him out. The people in Lo Debar and Rogalim and Rabbah, they sent him supplies to help him get refreshed. Because remember, Ahithophel's advice was good advice. They were fled Jerusalem and they're tired and weary and they're not organized, and that would have been the best time to attack. Well, he had enough time to get to Mahanaim and then get refreshed and organized and ready for a battle with his son. And so Psalm 3, if you want to turn there, lets us get an idea of how David felt when this took place. In verse 1, it says, Lord, Psalm 3, says a psalm of David when he fled Absalom, his son. And this very well could be the place where he wrote it when he's in Mahanaim. Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Now he's got the whole nation coming after him at this point. And he was under big time stress, you can imagine. His family has rejected him. By the way, where are his other sons? Where are, you know, he has 20 sons? Well, 19, because Amnon is dead now. But he has 19 other sons, and two of them are too young. Solomon and the other one, the other son from Bathsheba, they're too young. So there's 17 other sons. Well, it turns out they were appointed to administrate his kingdom, and so they're like chief administrators that are placed in different parts of Israel, mostly in Judah. But where are they? There's no mention of them at all. What happened to them? Have you ever thought of that? You won't find it in the scriptures. There's no mention of them. In fact, the last time we see the brothers together, remember when Absalom had the sheep shearing festival? That's when all the brothers and the one sister that we know of went to the festival. They brought their families. That's the last time they were together. Well, what happened there? They saw their brother Amnon murdered by Absalom. And that's the last we ever hear of them. And there just isn't this. We don't hear much of anything about David and his sons. Just not there. Did they come to their father's side to encourage him and help him and do it? What can we do, Dad, to help you out? There's no mention. David is in it. It's like he's been rejected by his own family. Now, it's possible that he told him to stay out of it. It's possible David, but there's no mention of that. But knowing David, he probably would have told him, you know, stay out of it. It's between me and Absalom. Stay out of it. You can almost see that, but it doesn't say that. So we're left to speculate on that. But I find it rather curious that there's no mention of his sons. The only son we're reading about right now is Absalom. That's it. So David is in a lot of stress at this point, and how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. Remember that Nathan had prophesied that he would have adversity in his family for the remainder of his life. And so perhaps there were those who heard the prophecy, and so they're saying, well, God's not going to help you. He told you you're going to have adversity. Think about that. How would you like to have that? Be told, well, God's not going to help you. You're going to have adversity. He's not going to. Does that mean I stop praying? And does that mean I just sort of give up? Is that what you do? Did Job give up? What did Job do now think of Job with me. This thought just occurred to me. Job got to a point where he had lost all his family except his wife, and he's sitting on an ash heap, and he's taking broken pieces of pottery and he's scraping the boils on his skin. That's where he's at. He's at the lowest point. And his friends have already come and told him, well, it's because of some sin you did. You know, you need to confess those sins so that you can get out of this terrible situation. And that's all done. And so there he is scraping the boils on his skin. And his wife is coming toward him. And, oh, good, my wife, she's going to give me some comfort. And as she gets there, she says to him, why don't you just curse God and die? I mean, the last family member that you have comes and tells you. Can anybody relate to that? Your family's rejected you? Job, how did he respond to that? Even though you curse me, as he talked to the Lord, Lord, even though you curse me, yet will I trust you. Lord, even though you curse me, yet will I trust you. Isn't that something? You know, in the average person, what they'll do is they'll shake their fist. They'll shake their fist at God. Why have you let me down? Why did you allow this in my life? Rather than just praising God for the situation in your life. Because after all, it's that situation that you're in that he's going to teach you what three things? Faith, hope, and love. He's teaching you those three things. Oh, by the way, that you will take with you throughout eternity. And you know something? It's my opinion, my humble opinion, that there's something about learning faith here and now in these bodies made of dirt. There's something unique about learning faith in these bodies that are prone to pain and suffering. Think about that. And you won't have the same opportunity to learn about faith and hope and love, except for the fact that you're in these bodies. And the uniqueness of those three things, faith, hope, and love, the uniqueness of them. And yet we get so sidetracked and so off onto other tangents, we lose out on what God's trying to show us, on those three that remain. And we just sort of push them aside and we seek comfort and we turn to our drugs. And I got to get, you know about the opioids? You've heard about the opioid epidemic we're having in this country right now? How many people are dying a day from overdoses due to opioids, drugs? Mostly painkiller drugs that you get stuck on and then the next thing you know you're... And a lot of it is because of emotional pain, taking the drugs, and it's not just that, it's alcohol, same thing. But it's a real problem. In fact, there's this passage in Revelation, it says that when God is judging the earth and when his judgment is getting worse and worse and when it's coming down harder and harder, it says that the people refuse to repent of their drugs. Now it doesn't say drugs. It says the Greek is pharmakia. They refuse to repent of their magic arts, and the Greek for magic arts is pharmakia, which is where we get the word pharmacy. And what do you get in a pharmacy? You get drugs. And so we're so into getting rid of the pain. There's nothing wrong with wanting to get rid of it. I want to get rid of pain just as much as you do. In fact, when I had my... I shouldn't tell you. when I was done, it hurt. And they gave me Vicodin. You know, I didn't know what it was. Well, they gave me the other stuff. The what's it called? No. Yeah, it's oxycodone, but they use it in World War II all the time. They'd stick them in. What is it? Morphine. Yeah, they put me on morphine. When I came out of that, then the pain came. it lasts about a day, right? And so it was a day later. Oh, this is great. Look at me. I can walk up and I can mow the lawn. But the thing is that then the pain kicked in. I said, "Where are those pills?" And they were Vicodin. You know what Vicodin is? I took one of those pills. Man, the pain went up. Wow, that's great. And I told my parents, this is a while back, and my mom says, "Well, you just go easy on them. Just only take them if if it's really hurts. Then just take the edge off. Don't get into it where you don't want any pain, because if you do that, you can find yourself wanting to go to the doctor and get more." By the way, the doctors, medical doctors, they will give you whatever you want. I mean, "I want more pain." They'll give it to you. There's like no control over that. What the doctors, it's true. I don't know why I'm on this, but pain is something that is part of this life. Emotional pain, stress, and all of these things that we want to avoid. And yet the Lord is trying through this pain and the suffering that we're in. He wants us to learn about three things. He wants us to learn about faith. He wants us to learn about there's hope. And he wants us to learn about love. He wants to learn those things. Otherwise, you otherwise wouldn't have, if once you get your perfect body, it's not going to be the same once you get your perfect body. And so what you learn now about faith, what you will take with you throughout eternity, and that faith that you learn now will be the faith that you use throughout eternity. Yeah. But you will still have it. You will still use that faith that you learn now in eternity, because God is depending on you to trust Him even through eternity when you're in your new body. Remember, Lucifer had a perfect body and he was perfect in every way. And what did he do? He sinned, right? Adam had a perfect body and he was perfect in every way. And then what did he do? He sinned, right? So what is the Lord trying to teach us? He wants us to learn faith, to trust Him. If you are a kind of person that you want to know how everything works down to the minutest detail, be careful. Because that's Satan's. That's his thing. He wanted to learn in other words, He says, "I will become like the Most High. I will be like the Most High." He wanted to be just like God and knowing everything. God has reserved for Himself certain knowledge that you will never have. And He wants you to be content with the knowledge that He is giving you. Oh, and oh, by the way, you'll be learning through the rest of eternity. I mean, think about all the subjects just in this world. There's so many different subjects I'd love to study. I'm one of these study guys, okay? I didn't like reading until I became a Christian. In fact, I went through most of my college without reading. I don't know how I did, but I mean, well, they're called Cliff Notes. You read it real fast, and then you write something down, and then they grade you. And that's how it worked. Okay, maybe some of you can anybody relate to that? Okay, lived on Cliff Notes. Okay. David was a guy who wanted to trust God in his situation. So here he is, and knowing that things are bad. But this is what he says in verse 3 of Psalm 3. "But you, O Lord, are a shield for me." Now he could have shaken his fist at God. "Why have you allowed this adversity in my life? I thought you forgave me," right? "I confess my sins. I thought all is forgiven and I didn't have to deal with this anymore. Why is it now that I'm having to deal with this? Look at my family. It's a mess and I'm exiled once again. What's going on, Lord? Why are you allowing this in my life? Look at there, even the people that are around me saying there's no help from God." And what does he do? He says in verse 3, "But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. You're my strength." And by the way your head gets lifted up is when you put your confidence in Him. And when you're totally down and out and you can't move, He'll give you the strength to get up and move. When you put your confidence in Him. He's the lifter of your head. And I cried to the Lord with my voice, and He heard me from His holy hill. You see, it says He cried with His voice, just so you be clear. He wasn't just crying from His heart, where you can cry from your heart and not make a sound, right? It's saying, I cried to the Lord from my voice. In fact, the people in camp may have heard Him as He cried out to the Lord. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and He heard me from His holy hill. How do we know that He heard Him? By the way, the word Selah, you know what that means? It's there for the purpose of for you to just stop for a moment and reflect on what was just said. Selah. Stop for a moment and reflect on what was just said. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and He heard me from His holy hill. And then what happened? Verse 5. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. He knew that the Lord heard him, because what happened? He went to sleep, and he fell asleep, and he woke up refreshed. And only the Lord can do that in his circumstance, when everything's fallen apart. The whole thing is on his shoulders. The whole state of Israel, including all the promises from God, are on his back. And yet, what he's doing is he's giving it back to the Lord. Verse 6, and I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Notice he's saying, why? It's because of the Lord. I'm not going to be afraid of what man can do to me. Isn't that what Jesus said? Don't be afraid of what man can do to you, but fear him who can destroy both your soul and body in hell. Why should I be afraid of any man? And then he goes on to say, after he says, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people. Arise, O Lord, verse 7, save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord, and your blessing is upon your people. And what does David say in the midst of this discouragement, and he's being told, yeah, look, you're in adversity, it's your fault. And what does he do? He says, Lord, you're still in charge, and I trust you that you're going to do what you said you're going to do, and I'm going to take it. I'm going to take the pain. Just going to take it. Let's go to chapter 18 of 2 Samuel. And David numbered the people who were with him and set captains and thousands and captains of hundreds over them. Now, David had a great night's sleep, just like we read in Psalm 3. He woke up, he was refreshed, he had given it all to the Lord. I'm going to trust you, and now let's get down to business. And I'm going to trust that you're going to work in this. And so he organizes. Remember, Ahithophel said, don't let him organize, because once he gets organized, you're going to lose. And Absalom didn't listen to Ahithophel. And remember what it said there? For the Lord was going to frustrate Absalom's plans. Ahithophel was correct. Hushai was the one who planted this idea to give David time. And now David's taking advantage of that time. He's organizing his troops. Verse 2, then David sent out 1/3 of the people under the hand of Joab. That's his greatest commander of all time, I believe. 1/3 under the hand of Abishai, who is the brother of Joab. And then it says, and 1/3 under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. Now, Ittai the Gittite is from Philistine. He's from Gath. And guess when he arrived in Jerusalem? The day before David fled from Absalom, Ittai brings with him 600 men. He's fleeing from the region of the Philistine country. He's fleeing from Gath, and he's seeking exile in Israel. And guess what he finds there? He finds David is getting ready to leave. And David says, well, look, you guys are, you've been under a lot of stress. You guys just stay here with Jerusalem. Absalom will leave you alone. And he goes, no, I'm going to come with you. And I'm going to bring my men with you. So Ittai comes with David. And here Ittai now is going to be fighting alongside David to protect him from his own son. And the king said to the people in verse 2 at the end, I also will surely go out with you myself. David, remember, has a warrior's mind. He's in his 60s, though. He's not what he used to be. He's not that mighty. He doesn't have the strength that he used to have. But he still decided, I'm going to go out with you. But look at verse 3. But the people answered, you shall not go out, for if we flee away, they will not care about us, nor if we, half of us die, they will they care about us? If half of us die, will they care? They don't care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us, for you are now more help to us in the city. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. And so the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. So they were able to talk to David. David understood what they were saying. The very advice that Ahithophel had given to, no, go in and get David, cut off the head of the snake. That's what they're saying right here. It says, no, no, they're coming after you. What difference does it make if half of us die? They want you. And so David understood their point, and so he moved, stepped aside and let these three commanders, who are very experienced, the commanders, do the fighting for him. Verse 5, now the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captain's orders concerning Absalom. Now, even though Absalom, David's son, had done what he did to his dad, he still loved him. He loved his son. He had every right to hold a grudge against Absalom for what Absalom did and undermining him and his authority. But you see, the love of a father for a son, that can't be changed. And David was in that situation right now. He loved Absalom, and he did not want anything to happen to his son Absalom, even though his son was way out of line. Verse 6, so the people went out into the field of battle against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. Now I want to show you where that is, and that gets a little confusing if you look on the map up here. So David is over here. There's the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. Here's Israel over here. This is foreign territory. And David has exiled himself in Mahanaim. He's here. And Absalom is up here. So they're organized there, and David's organized there. And then they confront each other, in the woods of Ephraim. And Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim is over on this side of the river, so it's a little unclear as to what the woods of Ephraim are. But as you read through the text, what we learn is that David stayed over on the other side of the Jordan until everything was settled, and then he finally left Mahanaim and left that area and crossed back over the Jordan to take his rightful place as king in Jerusalem. So he didn't really cross. Some think, well, he fought over here in this region on the other side of the Jordan. He didn't do that. They probably had their battle right here in the mountain, in the forest. There's a forest right along the top of this ridge. This is a mountain ridge, and then this valley drops down to the river, and that's where the battle took place. Verse 7, the people of Israel were overthrown. There were there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. 20,000, that's a lot. 20,000. For the battle, there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. I don't know what that means, the woods devoured. It's not clear. I looked up the commentaries, what they had to say. They didn't have anything to say. But I don't know if when you're in a rugged area, and there's cliffs and things like that, it's possible that they, instead of the sword killing them, they went over a cliff. I don't know. we don't, it's not real clear how more of them died from devoured by the woods than by the sword. It's not clear. But verse 9, then Absalom met, or he ran into the servants of David. So Absalom rode on a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of the a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, and the mule in which he was under him went on. Remember that Absalom, he cut his hair once a year, and the amount of hair that he cut off weighed 5 pounds. He had very thick hair, and so he had a big clump of hair, and he went under a tree, and a branch of the tree caught him by the hair, and now he's hanging in the air. Feet can't touch the ground, and he's stuck. The mule goes on, and there he is. Now a certain man, verse 10, saw it and told Joab and said, I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. So Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him, and why did you not strike him there to the ground? He said, I would have given you the 10 shekels of silver and a belt. But the man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware lest you touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life. In other words, if I killed Absalom, I'd be in big trouble. For there's nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. In other words, I don't trust you, Joab. You could have turned against me too, so I'm not going to do it. Verse 14, then Joab said, I cannot linger with you. In other words, you're wasting my time. You're just wasting my time. And he took 3 spears, now probably daggers. These are daggers. Joab takes 3 daggers in his hand and thrust them into Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. And 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him. So they finished Absalom off to make sure he was dead. Verse 16, so Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods, and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. So Joab is now dead. The sound for the victory was sounded and passed on through the region. Everybody knows now that it's over, and they can stop fighting. And then we read a little bit about Absalom. It says this is sort of like a little addendum or something that's added. Verse 18. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set a pillar for himself, which is in the King's Valley. Which is the King's Valley is the Kidron Valley, the valley just outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's up on a hill. You go down in this valley, the Kidron Valley. It's the King's Valley, and then you come back up to the Mount of Olives. Well, he set up a monument there. And for he said, verse 18, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and to this day it is called Absalom's monument. Now this is interesting. It's curious to me because he had 3 sons. We know 3 sons and a daughter. And what became of his sons? And remember, this had to have happened before he was killed, right? Obviously. So something must have happened to his sons. Did they pass away? Is that what happened? Or it's not clear. There's nothing in Scripture that lets us know. But anyway, he felt that he had to build this monument for his name. Monument for his name. Why do we build monuments for ourselves? Why do we do that? Why do we do that? Why do I? Okay, let's say I put in more than 51% for a big building, and let's say it's a charitable cause, it's a hospital, and at the top of the building it says Hogensen. Why would I do that? I mean, when you get into motives about why people do things, well, Saul, remember, he built a monument for himself. And God said, hey, you're not the one. Now Absalom hears he built a monument for himself. What did Joshua say? Well, I want to show you, by the way, I want to show you this monument. It's actually, there it is. I saw that when I was in Israel. In fact, that's after. Now, there's some who say, no, that's not Absalom's tomb, but it's in the King's Valley. It's right where it's supposed to be, and it's very, very old. There it is again. You can see it right here. There, right there. And all these back here, these are all graves. The Mount of Olives is up here. Okay, this is the King's Valley down here. Jerusalem's over here. There's another angle. There it is, Absalom's tomb. All these are graves. You know why the Jews want to be buried on the side of Mount of Olives? Because that's where the Zechariah 14 tells us the Messiah is going to land. They want to be there when he comes, and so they want to be buried on. That's why all those graves are there. Isn't that interesting? The Jews are Orthodox Jews. The burial of the body is very important to them. So I'm gonna go to the. I'm gonna get into the fire and have them put me in a little jar. Whatever they put on my tombstone, that's fine. There's another one. Another shot. Another angle. Yeah, right there. It's right there. Now, Joshua, when they crossed the Jordan River and the Israelites crossed the Jordan into the Promised Land, they set up 12 stones, pillars, as memory pillars. Whoever sees those pillars there would be reminded of what took place when God divided the Jordan River for them to cross by. And so it's one thing to have a memory stone. That's one thing. We have grave markers or memory stones. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's okay. I don't want to get too weird, about that, because we don't want to be legalistic, do we? Because whenever you get into that kind of thing, it's a temptation to get legalistic, but that's not what we're doing here. So what did Joshua do? What was the last thing he told Israel? He had just led the people of Israel across the Jordan. They conquered the land. They divided up the land. And what is the last thing that Joshua tells the people? He says in Joshua 24:15, "And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve." Notice it's a choice. He's pro-choice here. Yeah. "Choose whom you will serve, whether the gods which your father served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell." You make the choice who you're going to serve. "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." That's it. That's it. That struck me so heavily. When we first moved into our house, I wanted to give my house to the Lord. We went into every room and we prayed over all the walls, and we even took oil and anointed the. I mean, we were really radical Assemblies of God type people, Pentecostal. I was raised in a Baptist church, but we did it. I don't care what church I was raised in. That's what we did. We went in and we anointed the walls. We prayed over, because the people that lived in there, we don't know what went on. We don't know what happened in those rooms. So we asked the Lord's anointing. We don't know about, any evil kind of entities. We don't know that. So you ask the Lord, "Lord, please help. And we trust you with this, and we pray over and anoint this house. This house is for you." And then when I expanded my driveway, it was a single driveway, so I made it a double. And the cement that I put in there up to our brick front porch that I put into, right there at the base of the porch, I put Joshua 24:15. Because that's my heart to serve the Lord. Me and my family, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And that's it. That's it. That's my little monument. That's it. We're almost done. Let's go back to chapter 18, verse 19. And we'll just read through the rest of this, because then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, who's the priest, the high priest, or a priest, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. He obviously doesn't really, he's a young guy, and he doesn't realize that this isn't going to be good news to the king, so why would you want to go run to the king and tell him that your son's dead? That's not going to go over well. He didn't get it, obviously, at this point. And Joab said to him, you shall not take the news this day, for you shall not take the news, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead. In other words, you know, just let it lie, let it be still. Then Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you have seen. And so the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. Now this is interesting. Joab knew that it could be trouble, and he knew Ahimaaz. What's his name again? Yeah, Ahimaaz. He knew he's the son of a priest, and he knows he's a younger guy. So he said, to spare him some trouble, because Joab figured there could be some trouble, he sent the Cushite. Okay, and the Cushite's not an Israelite. Joab's a shrewd guy. He's no dummy. And so so the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. Verse 22, and Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, and whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. So Joab said, well, why will you run, my son? He's a young guy. Since you have no news ready. That's an interesting, it's like a riddle. You got to figure that out. You have no news ready, so why run? But whatever happens, he said, let me run. So he said to him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate to the wall, lifted his eyes and looked, and there was a man running alone. Then the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, if he is alone, there is news in his mouth. And he came rapidly and drew near. Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, there is another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. So the watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he is a good man and comes with good news. So Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, all is well. And then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. Then the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? Now you know exactly what's on David's heart. The very first thing he asked him, how's Absalom? How's he doing? And then Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. Now remember what Joab told him? You have no news. Right? And that's what he's doing here. He's saying, there was a tumult, but I don't know what it's about. In other words, I have no news. And so the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood there. Verse 30 and 31. Just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, there is good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? And so the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you do to harm be like that young man. Then the king was deeply moved and went up into the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, so my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, O Absalom, my son, my son. And so David takes the news very hard, and he begins to mourn and weep, and outwardly, right in front of the people. And as we will pick up next week, we'll see where this leads, which is rather interesting. Let's stand. And these three remain, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. The greatest of these is love. So as you go out this week into your busy activities, remember what God's priorities are. He wants you to learn faith. He wants you to have hope in Him, knowing that He's your deliverer. And in the midst of that, He wants you to learn about His love. In Jesus' name, amen.